Hi, I am Esther Zachariah, an occupational therapist and post-professional occupational therapy doctoral student at Boston University. I am interviewing Arput Martin Sam, who works at Herpetburg Christian Hospital in India. And he has been an OT for the past 5 years. The particular hospital that he works at is in rural parts of North India, and he is currently the oldest occupational therapist there. So Martin, hi.
Hi Esther.
How are you doing?
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing fine as well. Did you have a long day at work today?
Oh yes, I did. But all good now.
All good now. What happened at work today?
I was catching up on some assignments of mine.
Okay.
Catching up on a lot of pending assignments, so that made a long day.
Right. Okay. So Martin is doing his master's in rehabilitative science, which is quite tricky given that he is the only OT that is managing 120 children. Am I right?
Yeah, something like that. Something around that, yeah.
Right. Okay. So, Martin, coming to a few questions that I had for you, could you describe a lived experience where you think you've been able to make an impact because you were an OT?
Well, I'm used to working in a community-based rehab team.
Okay.
And so I haven't been able to, when I look back, I don't see an individual event or an individual act of mine that has brought about an impact. However, I've been part of a team that's been able to create an impact in the community. To explain that, in a village near our center, which had around 50, 60 odd people with disabilities, there was no awareness of disability. People had dropped out of school because of stigma. They had no access to their basic rights as a person with disability. They did not know the entitlements. So all of that was happening in that village. We as a team were able to form a group in that village. So it's called a disabled people's group. So we gathered all the 50, 60 odd people with disability together, trained them on what their rights are, and what they possibly could become, and help them think through things that have been barriers in their own lives. And now in the course of 4 years, 4.5 years, they are a group that's registered with the government. So they are now a group with a name of their own. And they see each member in the group who was scattered and out of sorts previously is now active member in the group. So which means they have got back to living a functional and productive life. Some who had dropped school have completed their schooling. Some who didn't have jobs, not everyone, some have gone out and found jobs for themselves. And all of them now have awareness of their entitlements, and they all access government offices, their caste votes, and they become responsible citizens in their families. Basically, they've come out of their own state of self-pity. They become a responsible person in their family, and now they're also a contributing member in the community. So people in the community approach the group now to address problems in the community. For example, they've been contacted to do a cleanliness, what do you call it, a cleanliness campaign in the community. They've been called for various events, to conduct various events in the community. And since they have good network with the government, even people approach them to approach the government. So they become a medium of communication between them and the government, them and other NGOs. So that's a transformed community now. That's something that I've had the opportunity to be part of and witness. And so my role specifically there has been to see if anybody requires an aid and requests any aids and appliances, if anybody needed a home modification, or if anybody needed some basic therapy or needed some direction as to what to do with the capacity or potential they have. So it's mostly been guiding and mentoring people. So that way I was able to contribute to the team that did the other bit of it.
That's interesting. So what do you think, how were you able to mobilize people into these disabled people's group, or what are the strategies did you use, that helped you to facilitate this?
The first thing was to identify the needs in the community, to go out in the community and explore what the needs are, and this was something that stood out. The second thing was to build a relationship with people there, because you're an outsider and not everybody will accept you, because there are so many NGOs, that so many organizations basically, that also misuse people with disabilities. So building a relationship was one of the important things that we did for nearly a year or so before we formed the group. And once the relationships are built, we had to set a value system for the group. So forming a value system was the other step. Value system in the sense to form a vision statement, to form their core principles and stuff like that, that will unite them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically putting those principles together was another important thing. And then the third important thing was to help people understand what they possibly need to receive or possibly are entitled to receive. You know, so awareness was the third thing. So providing as much as awareness as possible to these people so that they stand on their own feet. And lastly, it would be a continuous follow-up with these people. You know, you started the group and you just can't leave them where they are, but you constantly follow up and make sure that the group is running and continue to help in any possible way.
All right. Do you think have you only been involved in disabled people's groups, or were you involved in other aspects as well? And did you face any issues with finances when you were trying to facilitate all of this?
Just finances or any other challenges?
You can go ahead and describe any challenges that you faced while trying to do or work as an OT in that area.
Well, other than the disabled people's group, I've been working with children on a regular basis. So children, the range right from 2 years to 18 years, and children with a range of disabilities, both developmental disabilities and acquired disabilities. But one of the challenges that came across would be the children, the adolescent children. Two groups of children that were quite challenging. One is the adolescent group that could not benefit so much from direct therapeutic interventions, and who need to live independent or interdependent life in the community. It's been challenging to find a platform for them. There aren't places or there aren't resources that will equip them so that they can stand on your own feet, or not just own feet, or even in a supported environment, it's hard to find a platform here. So that's one challenge we are facing for these children. And the other group of children are children who don't fit into mainstream schools, nor they don't fit in the into a special school. So they aren't disabled so much that they would fit into a special school, but at the same time, they wouldn't perform too well in the mainstream school. So we lack facilities, or we lack human resource and finances to have the human resource to take care of such children.
All right. So when you say they don't fit into schools, or, you know, yeah, they're not as disabled enough to fit into a special school, what do you mean by yeah. that?
Yeah, so basically, in the center that I work in, we have children mostly with profound disabilities. So children who have very poor literacy skills, who need support in their ADLs, and who have quite some physical impairments as well. So these children are mostly in the daycare center, and we provide services to them. But there are a certain group of children that go to school regularly. For example, they have a mild, they're on the spectrum, but with mild autism, or they've got learning disability. You know, so they don't fit into our center because we don't have a curriculum, or not because they don't fit, but because we don't have a curriculum for them. We don't have the facilities for them. The same with the school. The school doesn't have an environment for them to learn and grow. So, I mean, I think to rephrase it, it's not that they don't fit, it's that we don't have an environment and the human resource to accommodate them.
That's an interesting thought, where you say that we're not enough to have them in our center, rather than having them fit into a certain box. That's an interesting thought. So when you say that someone has a profound disability, I understand that you, being an occupational therapist, would be able to assess which child has profound disability, or which child goes into, like you mentioned, a certain curriculum, and which child does not fit into a certain curriculum. But what happens to the children who don't come to your center and are rejected by the school? How is the government able to make these categories, if I should say it that way, how is the government able to call these shots?
I think the government, personally, the government has great laws, great policies on paper, but we don't see an access to that, or we don't see them being implemented. They probably are elsewhere, practitioners are in our locality, they aren't. So they aren't the ones we bank on, though we expect them to help. It's just a challenge that we are facing with presently no concrete answers.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, as far as I have read, I've read that disability is assessed by a doctor who has a certain disability percentage by which somebody is given a disability card. Am I right?
Yes, you're right.
All right. And you are saying that the disability card is not implemented properly. Is that what you're saying?
No, the disability card is given, but again, children, like I said, children who go into schools and who have basic life skills, they don't get categorized in the disability field itself, because mean, the questionnaires or the way the children with disability are, the criteria that is made for people with disabilities doesn't actually categorize every child with disability into a group. Certain ones that are obvious get a disability certificate, but for certain children who, in whom the disability is not obvious, then they get missed out.
Interesting. All right. So, how do you think OT fits into CBR? How, I mean, we all know that OT does fit into CBR and how that entire system works, we understand that, but do you have something to tell us in terms of how does your OT degree fit into the current situation you are in? Current center that you're working in?
OT in a community based rehab is something that you, firstly, is something that you learn. Something that you learn as you work. I mean, you do learn some theory in your undergrad course, but it's something that you, like, for example, when you start your career as an OT in a CBR project, you often cannot have set rules or a set guideline saying, okay, this is the role of OT in a CBR. Yes, there are a few points you can list out, but those don't really work out. For example, 5 years back, I would say I really don't know how an OT would fit into CBR, but now, after having worked in a CBR project for a bit, my role mainly is, as an OT, your role mainly is to promote inclusion, you know, in your through your college, through your 4 years of studies, you're mostly taught to be a therapist, somebody who does basic interventions, who intervenes, who provides direct intervention. But in the CBR project, you can't limit yourself to that. You need to be more than that to look at other things. Yes, intervention is one part. Providing therapy is one part of your job description. But more than that, you look at the entire community. You look at the community needs. You can't address just disability, but you need to address the person's need in a holistic manner. So you look at occasion, you look at their livelihood, you look at their social aspects to see how his relationships are, how the family is doing. And you look at if the person has enough access to the government. I mean, you see if the person is empowered enough to be on his own. So there are different things that as an OT you need to evolve to look at. So you can't live in your small nutshell of just ADL and sensory integration and fine motor and stuff like that, you know. So you need to grow beyond that to be a CBR project. That's what I've learned.
That's very interesting. I liked how you said it's about inclusion. That's a very nice capsule that you've put it into. So you've talked about, you know, you've learned many things, or you learned that OT cannot fit into a nutshell. Do you have other lessons that you've learned as an OT? Overall, all of combining all the years of experience that you have, do you have any other lessons that you've learned being an OT in a CBR project? And how did you learn them? Were there certain experiences? Would you like to share?
Yeah, well, one of the learnings is, I mean, at least your training, while you're trained, you do have different frameworks and approaches to treatment. And always, especially with disability, you know, at the end of the day, you do an assessment and you identify the main problems, and then you set goals. So basically, the goals that you set is to change the child with disability or the person with disability from where they are to something else. No. So at the end of the day, when you assess a child and assess a person with disability, you're looking at two sides of them. You're looking at one is a side where they are now, and a side where they're supposed to be. You know, that's always you've been trained as an OT. But working, I've realized that you always can't. At least I've considered myself a failure, or not a great OT probably, not being able to get the people I work with across the other side. I mean, none of them reach their goals. None of them think, or none of them become the person I want them to become. You know, so always there was this a feeling of incompetency as to why aren't they becoming what my goals are. And aren't my goals practical, or are they? But then I've realized that when you're working with disability as an OT, you can't change a person, you know, but you need to accommodate the environment, you need to accommodate your attitudes so that they fit into, so basically the normal that you think is not normal for them. You know?
Right.
So you can't change them to whom you think they need to become. But rather, you need to accommodate, or you need to create environment, or you need to break those barriers, see how they can be themselves and not become someone else whom you think they should become. So thinking that way helps work with people better. You know, it helps recognize them as something different, as someone different. They don't have to become the same normal that you are. They can be different, and that is still okay. It's okay to be a disabled person who's not reaching the goals, who's not attaining everything. But the more we emphasize on changing them, I think it probably leads to frustration. So it's better to accommodate them with their so-called deficits, so-called this one, but at the same time, create an environment where their abilities can be maximized, or change attitudes so that they can also fit into your life times.
That's quite profound. Can you share if, or who do you think has had the most influence on you, on your career as an OT?
It should be the people with disabilities themselves, because had I just read the textbooks and had I not had the opportunity to share in their lives, I don't think I'd have learned what I've learned. I know it's learning is a lifelong process, and while there are people, I mean, my seniors or my in-charges or my colleagues, they all teach me things. But if it's not for people with disabilities and the people I work with, then I would never learn what is intended for me to learn, both professionally and personally. So yeah, I think they're the ones who have impacted my life.
Yeah. I guess if I was asked the question, I probably would have said the same thing. Because, no. I mean, to come to another person to ask for help is in itself quite humbling for the person who is asking for help. And to trust somebody to do that is also, it puts the OT in a place of influence, which is actually quite humbling. So you're right. I don't think any of us would have become the OTs we are today if it weren't for those people who Let us be OTs, I guess.
Yep.
And I guess, do you think that this learning has come because you are in a CBR project, or it would have come if you were in another place?
I don't know. Probably there might be different learnings in a different place. But or this could have come as learning there as well. I haven't worked anywhere else. So, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Interesting. Who do you think you're most grateful for? For your career? Grateful to your career.
I mean, like, personally?
Well, what do you feel most grateful for in your career as an OT? So, personal, professional, either way.
Grateful. So basically, I'm grateful because, I mean, people do mold you, but more than that, the profession is highly, I mean, OT as a profession is something that, okay, wait, let me put it another way. For example, most people have a professional life and a personal life. But as an OT, I think you cannot have a double life, because as an OT, who you are defines how influential of a therapist you could be, you know. So the more empathetic you are as a person, the more empathetic you'd be as a therapist. The more creative you are as a person, the more creative you could be at work. So basically, all the qualities that you need for a profession are qualities that need to be inherited personally. So unless you change yourselves, or unless you grow to be a different person, you'll never be a OT. So that way, I think I'm grateful for the profession that it's molded me to change myself before I step into changing someone else's lives.
Wow. Well, that was a very heavy interview. Thank you so much, Martin, for your time. This has been very enriching, I guess, for me. Thank you for sharing your thoughts and your experiences with me.
Thank you, Esther. Yeah, thank you for patiently listening. And all the best for studies.